Matthew and the Christian community.
I think we better hurry and get into it because we've got only till about 8:30, and I can't imagine that we would have had a more dramatic introduction to the whole question of what Matthew can mean and Matthew's whole call to the new community can mean for the Christian community today, a more dramatic setting it up than we just had. How are we going to say our powerful no's and our yeses in a way that will change things? What I want to do in this presentation is to talk about the Sermon on the Mount as a serious model for the Christian community. Any Christian community, but in terms of what we're doing here this week, particularly the Christian community, which is any Lutheran parish in the United States, and the Christian community, which is Holden Village, your primary Christian community, and the Christian community, which is Wartburg Seminary, my primary Christian community. Before we go into it, I want to pick up a couple strands from earlier presentations and try to tie them in here. Monday night, I deliberately recalled the Lutheran seminarian, told you about him, who said he would not preach on the text, "Your righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees," because he said it sounds like works righteousness, and he had been taught as a good Lutheran to avoid that at all costs. And give or take a little, that's where I think most of us in the Lutheran ethos either stand or have stood. And we are still trying to deal within our tradition with the old formulation that the Sermon on the Mount, this place here in Matthew's redaction, which you notice is either blue or white. White is material unique to Matthew. Blue is material that Matthew shares with Luke. Biblical scholars call it Q. The Sermon on the Mount, which runs here from 5 to the end of 7, is all blue or white. Mark can tell the story of Jesus without a Sermon on the Mount, which is very interesting. Now, I want us to have sort of quivering in front of us here tonight the interpretive principle that I think we were all taught in our Lutheran tradition, that the Sermon on the Mount is such a splendid, impossible vision of what Christianity should be. And think about its value and its danger. So that's the first strand I want to pick up. The second one is from this morning, where we went through Crosby's social economic reading of Matthew, particularly what he calls a housetopple or table of duties, here going from chapter 19, talking about marriage and divorce, talking about the place of children, talking about riches, and then to this incredible parable of the laborers in the vineyard, which spells out God's freedom to be just and to give us hope when we see no hope, and also, according to Crosby, spelled out for the Christian communities in, or households rather, in Antioch, for whom Matthew was writing, spelled out how they should arrange correctly their human relationships, their work relationships, their status relationships, and how they should arrange justly their limited resources. From one point of view, this section, which Crosby calls a table of duties or Haustafel, is the same kind of material as we have here in the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew, writing about the year 85 to a specific situation, probably a large community or population of Christians divided into households in a semi-affluent stratum of the urban population of Antioch. These two sections call for the same kind of reaction and same kind of interpretation. Here, those are the two strands I want to bring in. And what I want to do in most of what I lead you into today is to steal some passion and some material from last year's inaugural address at Wartburg Seminary by my New Testament colleague, Jim Bailey. He has been teaching Matthew for a number of years, and the reason I'm here tonight daring to talk to you about Matthew is that Jim is going on sabbatical, and he asked me to take over the Matthew course the next 2 years, and so I'm about to learn something about Matthew because I said I'd do it, and when I was asked to come here to work on Matthew, I thought this gives me a good chance to learn something about Matthew so I can go into the classroom these next 2 years and have something to say. So you're kind of training me for my teaching these next 2 years. Jim Bailey's inaugural address, he titled Sermon on the Mount, Model for Community. Now, Jim Bailey comes out of the same tradition I come out of, the one you come out of. He's fighting and struggling to say, yes, we've got to get beyond an understanding of the Sermon on the Mount that simply says it is the great, perfect, legal picture of where we should be, but where we cannot be. So he began with the question, why don't congregations tap into the radical power of the Sermon on the Mount? Why don't they tap into that? The same question, perhaps stated another way, what might it mean for the life of a Christian congregation? Now, you said tonight in your meditation, we've got to start where we are. That's where we're going to meet God's Word, God's challenge. What we've got is not in the United States of America Christian households like apparently there existed, if Crosby is right, in the Christian population in Antioch. We've got congregations where you folks are preaching. We've got seminaries where I'm teaching. Those are the structures we've got. And so we have to ask the question of these present structures. What might it mean for the life of a Christian congregation, and this is Jim Bailey's wording, quote, to live in such a way that its life together would not make sense if God did not exist. It gears right into everything you were saying tonight. What might it mean for the life of a Christian congregation, your parish, to live in such a way that it's total program, everything it does, would not make sense if God did not exist. You probably recognize that that's an adaptation of a statement used to describe the life of Dorothy Day. I will follow, as I said, a lot of Jim's passion and content as we go through tonight's investigation. But I will sing, now is the right word obbligato when you sing a melody up above the other melody? Is that correct? A descant, or I will sing a descant, my own descant, or whatever it is, to his melody, and it will be a descant, or whatever the correct word is, that is both critical and applauding. Now, it's very interesting. Jim started his inaugural, where we've been working some, at the issue of genre, Gattung, or type. Remember Weichen, our helper, one of the earlier lectures, talked about the community of the new human being. That's what Matthew is all about, to establish a new community of a new human being. Crosby today talks about Matthew's call to shape new households of justice and mercy among the Christian population in Antioch. Jim Bailey, in his inaugural, his passionate inaugural, called more modestly for a contrast community, a designation he adopted from Lofink's book, Jesus and Community. How many of you know that book? I've not read it. You know it? Okay, well anyway, he adopted that, and it looks to me like it's a lower profile call than what you get in either Weichen or Crosby. And Jim began looking at the Beatitudes. And let me just ask you, as we're going to read this stuff, because there is absolutely no substitute in my mind for hearing the scripture. But I want you to ask yourselves, as you read these scriptures, is this really out of reach? Is this really all that impossible? And if so, why? Now, we discussed it in the text. That's what we were talking about this afternoon, that hour we were fighting with the text. Is it too high and wonderful for us? Or is there something here that is, even in terms of the first step, manageable, possible, for a community of people that claim to live from faith in God revealed in Jesus Christ, the new human being? Will someone just quickly read Matthew 5, 3 to 12? Let us just get the feel of it. Anybody who's near a light.
Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you.
Okay, just a simple question. Is that oversell? Or is there a sense in which that promise, blessed, rings true? Is that oversell, or is there a sense in which that promise, blessed, rings true? Now, one of the things that Jim Bailey tried to do in his inaugural was to say, in a sense, it is a promise blessed that rings true, because the first and the last Beatitudes give us an assured or almost assured eschatological promise and vision. Blessed are those who are peacemakers, those who are persecuted, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And I guess it translates into our question now, is, does the vision and the promise of the kingdom of heaven for you and for the Christian community today, for the Lutheran parishes of which you are pastors, is that a promise that rings true? Do people feel in the presence of that promise blessed? That's the first question. The next one that Jim Bailey asked and talked about, he said the starting point for the community is always poverty of spirit. Poverty of spirit. I was wondering, as Pitcher was doing his meditation tonight, if looking for God's word in the world is another way of talking about poverty of spirit. Waiting with a stance, an openness that says it must come from you, O God. Anyway, I want to ask, is that realizable, or is that a dream too far out? The next statement that Jim made about the alternative community was that it is focused, or the focus of a contrast community is always God's righteousness or dikaiosune. And let me read for you a little bit what he says about that. The focus for a contrast community is always on God's righteousness. The fourth and eighth Beatitudes focus on the Greek word dikaiosune. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And my colleague Jim Bailey says, Leander Keck provides a most useful definition of this difficult and favorite word of Matthew, dikaiosune, and we talked about that. Remember, we introduced it the first evening. And this is Keck's explication of what dikaiosune means. Righteousness is not simply goodness, rather it is rightness. The rightness attained by obeying the Torah as Jesus interpreted and exemplified it. Righteousness prevails where everything is right and rightly related to everything else, very much like the Old Testament concept shalom. Righteousness, in other words, is a way of expressing the moral ecology of the kingdom of heaven, where God's kingship is fully effective, there all things are right. I think the implication for what we've just been listening to about nature is simply right up front. Dikaiosune is thus a relational term. Jim Bailey would offer the following translation of the two Beatitudes. As a climax to the first stanza, the fourth Beatitude declares, those blessed who hunger and thirst for God's way of setting all things in right relationship. And then the second stanza ends by blessing those who are willing to suffer in service for these right relationships. Suffering comes to the community because these God's initiated right relationships precipitate hostile reactions from people in society who benefit from the conventional and most often oppressive ordering of relationships. So my question, my reality question to you and to me vis-a-vis our Christian communities is this. Do we take joy? Do we feel blessed that we are involved primarily in obeying God's righteousness, God's desire that all things be placed in the right relationship? Did you take joy tonight from that rather frightening meditation we had and say we together are going to be enabled to do something about it? That's the reality question again. Another characteristic, or a fourth characteristic, of the contrast community is the one I've just been talking about, Jim Bailey saying that it will always involve both joy and pain. And there again we have to ask, is this something that our congregations expect and rejoice in and see as part of the blessing, or is it just too much for them to face, or for us to expect of them, or for us to call them to in our preaching? And Jim Bailey spends a good bit of time at this point talking about how the sum total of this being involved up into God's movement towards righteousness, toward dikaiosune, will involve us in something he calls passion. And he has here a quote from Jürgen Moltmann's book, The Passion for Life, where Moltmann speaks directly to the last beatitude when he contrasts apathy, a virtue in the ancient world, with passion. And we had passion tonight in our meditation. Passion. Apathy, as the attempt to avoid all suffering, ironically misses the depth of involvement with life assumed by the Beatitudes. Assumed by the Beatitudes. It is precisely in the unconventional love of life that joy is experienced right alongside of profound pain. The community as a contrast community lines up with prophets in casting its lot for things as God wills them, not things as they are or as they appear to be. Not surprisingly, as a result, some persecution and some pain become daily companions for a contrast community. Now, I think we know that. Is the rest of the sentence true? I'll start the sentence over. Not surprisingly, as a result, some perception and some pain become daily companions for a contrast community, comma, but surprisingly, also present are deep rivers of joy. Now, is that real or is that oversell? In our lives as Christians or in the communities for which you preach and for which you are shepherd, guide, teacher, Do your people say, I know they're against us. I know we're going against the stream. I know we're criticized, but we're doing what God wants us to do. And my question is that something that really happens, really could happen, or is that just so much church theology of glory, church talk, the kind of talk that Douglas John Hall was warning against us against the first night when I was quoting him? That's the question I'm asking. Are these Beatitudes, as they've been sort of explained for us with his melody and my descant or whatever it is that, are the Beatitudes really experienceable and livable good news, or do they really crush us and our people? We have to say, we just can't even try. That's the question. Now let's look at the next section in the Sermon on the Mount. Jim Bailey entitles that section, I want somebody to read it, The Contrast Community Lives for the World. Somebody read Matthew 5, 13 to 16. Matthew 5, 13 to 16. Okay? Who's got it?
You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trodden underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hid. Nor do men light a lamp and put it under a bushel, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven.
Okay. 2 points there. Salt and light, according to my good friend Jim, and I'm not going to go through that whole discussion, are both gift and task. We have been given the gift of being salt and light, and somehow we must be that for the world. And then, as the conclusion of this particular section, you have what you just read, let your light so shine before others that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Jim Bailey writes about that. There are implications from this, especially for us Lutherans who are so afraid of works righteousness that we end up avoiding all good works. But this was not a hang-up for the Jesus of the Sermon on the Mount. It is precisely the community's good works by which it gives witness to a caring God and through which the community itself is shaped. A community is significantly formed by what it does. Our doing shapes us. Now again, I ask about this section. Is this something attainable in an average congregation, or is it too wild a dream? Now the next section, just going on through this part of the Sermon on the Mount, my friend Jim Bailey titles The Contrast Community Works Constantly at Right Relationships. Will somebody read Matthew 5, 17 to 20? I think we worked on that in part this afternoon on the text study. Will somebody read it, please?
Think not that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have come not to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot, will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever then relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches people so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But they who do them and teach them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven.
Unless your dikaiosune, your devotion to God's making things right, exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Remember, that's the passage our Lutheran student said he wouldn't preach on at all because it would suggest works righteousness. Now, there follows the six antitheses, which I think we will not read. Let me just give you the first a sentence of each one. Verse 21, you have heard that it was said to the people of old, you shall not kill, and whoever kills shall be liable to the judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother or sister shall be liable to the judgment. That's the first of the six antitheses. The second one is Matthew 5:27. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. The third antithesis, verse 31. It was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of unchastity, makes her an adulteress, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. The fourth antithesis, verse 38, you have heard that it was said, to the people of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. But I say to you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool. Then the fifth antithesis, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, do not resist one who is evil, but if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to that person the other also. And then the final antithesis, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. And then finally, the end of this section, you therefore must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Now, that was the section in part that we discussed in the text study this afternoon. And nothing raises the issue more dramatically than that. Now, what's going on here? Is this a taking of the old law and raising it legalistically to a higher, more impossible level, or is something else going on here? What did we say this afternoon about what was going on here? And then again, the question, is this totally impossible? Or is there something going on here that can be achieved? Some of you who were in the discussion this afternoon bring into it now what we said there. If you remember. But this is really a test. I mean, I have heard so many sermons on this, and they are all fitting into the old pattern. This is the, they say, people of old said, but I say to you, unto you, this is Jesus raising it up to the point that nobody can come near it, and so we throw ourselves on the mercy of the Lord. What's going on here?
Isn't this, isn't that, those six instances, you know, all of that material really ways Jesus is, illustrating how, you know, the righteousness or rightness is to exceed that of how scribes and Pharisees would understand it.
Can it translate into anything real in our congregations? That's the issue.
It seems to me, I may be misunderstanding, but it seems like we're going back to the classic Reformation argument, how many uses of the law are there? The second, is there a third use? The second, it seems to me the way that Lutherans have traditionally interpreted this is the second use. It shows us our unworthiness. Mm-hmm. What you're suggesting is the third use, that it's a guide for Christian living. Now, am I misunderstanding that?
I try very much to avoid the third use of the law when I teach New Testament, because I would like to use other categories. I think this is a vision or a challenge invitation or something like that. I don't know that I want to talk about the third use of the law. I avoid it for a lot of reasons. But it moves in that direction. That's kind of the way it moves. Let me just read to you what my friend Jim Bailey wrote about the six antitheses and ask the same question about his exposition that we asked about the stuff as I summarized them. Jim says, "Let me quickly sketch a few implications for a contemporary congregation which accepts the six antitheses as modeling right relationships for a contrast community." Now you have to be, I said that our descant or whatever it is going to be both applauding and critical. If you think what he's saying is oversell, then say so. The first three antitheses on anger, lusting, and divorce pertain to relationships within the Christian community and influence the effectiveness of its witness. Two of the three examples focus on male-female relationships, perhaps suggesting that the integrity of the community's witness hinged on how well women were treated in the community or how seriously it lived out its egalitarian character. In contemporary terms, neither verbal nor sexual abuse were to be tolerated in the community. Similarly, a Christian community today is to give primary attention to such relational issues. The full force of Jesus' hyperbolic language, and we discussed that this afternoon, if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off, etc., intends to shock the community into taking seriously abusive relationships which are often played down by society. Now, is that an adequate recasting for today of the force of those three antitheses? Now what Jim says about the last three antitheses. On honesty with words, non-retaliation, and love of enemies. These relate more directly to the community's contact with non-members. If anger and domination are not consistent with love, then such applies equally to situations involving those hostile to the community. Only love of enemies, not a feeling but chosen benevolent action, reflects God's impartial loving and has any chance of transforming the situation. Among other activities, a community needs to pray for enemies self-consciously and regularly. Do we do that? How many contrast communities in the Lutheran Church prayed through the Cold War for the families of the Russian people? I know a few who did. I know a few who did. In fact, I know one pastor who did it, I think, every Sunday during the Cold War. Is that too high a dream or calling? The final antithesis, love of enemies, thus provides the most profound test for the community as to whether or not it lives as a contrast community. This activity distinguishes the community from others in society. You know, as I read this, I keep thinking of the meditation tonight. Where do we find the ways of saying our loud, or maybe loving, no, 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 to the values and goals of this society? That's what we're talking about. This willingness to love unconditionally is the perfection or completeness which 5:48 offers when it says, be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect, which 5:40 offers as the deep task of the community and its goal in imitating what God has revealed to us in Jesus. Now again, I ask the same question. Is this too wild a dream? Is this something that can or cannot be approximated in a normal congregation of the American Lutheran Church? Or are we going to go, back to his first question, is there a power in these words and in this vision, in this call, in this challenge, that can be harnessed and used? Let's read the last section now that we're going to deal with tonight, 6:1-18. Will somebody just read that? We will read that.
Can I? Seems to me that the last thing we can do is stop, with just these instances. Well, it's the model of our life together in our life and the larger community.
I don't know exactly what you mean.
I don't think that Jesus was foreseeing everything that comes into play in our relationships within the community or without the community. This is a good beginning or a good place to begin, but it's not a place to stop. I certainly can't say to the people in the church I'm serving, our responsibility as a community for people who are divorced, our responsibility stopped when they got divorced. I mean, we can go on ignoring them now because they no longer fit into this very narrowed description of our responsibility in the community. Am I making?
I think so.
Yeah.
You're saying that. We talked about this this afternoon, so I'm sort of confused about.
Okay. Well, no. But you asked the question. You know, is this a model for, you know, our community today?
Is it a serious call?
That's
is
right.
Is it a serious
right.
invitation to live a new way?
Yes. And I was responding, yes, it is, but, you know, it's not a fence we can build around and feel like, you know, if this is what we're doing, that we're doing it all. I mean, we've got a whole raft of new responsibilities in light of, you know, the real world we're a part of. And Jesus did go on to deal with a woman at Sychar.
Yeah. Well, what we said yesterday when we were trying to discuss this and make some sense out of the sort of apparent upping of the legalistic requirement, we said two things. One, we said, on the one hand, Jesus seems at every point in the antitheses and so forth to be saying the law was this way, but it's even stronger now. But we said maybe what he's saying when he says something like, you have heard, thou shalt not kill, but anyone who hates is guilty in the same way. Maybe Jesus is calling to a different kind of spirituality, which says, let us not even plant the seed of hate that will grow into the act of murder. That was one of the things we said. And then the other thing that we said in trying to make sense out of this afternoon was that there is a very interesting phenomenon in both what we can learn from the Gospels about the Jesus community and certainly what we see in Paul interacting with his communities. On the one hand, there is sort of the non-negotiable, highest ethical demand you could imagine. On the other hand, the most open hand of grace and forgiveness than you could ever understand. That's the whole point of this, one of the points of the parable of the laborers in the vineyard. God is free to pay as much to the people who worked 1 hour as to those who worked the whole day. And somehow these two poles, both in the Jesus communities and the Paul communities, are held. Yes, sir.
It's not, even though this call to radical perfection is sometimes baffling, I can understand that, particularly as a call, as a summons, you know, as a model, mm-hmm. as something that we aim for. That fits. What is harder to fit is when it really does seem to be used as a criteria to exclude, and I'm thinking of in 5:29, where it says, "For I tell you that unless your past is that of the Pharisees and the teachers, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." Or in 5:30, where it says, "If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than your whole body to go to hell." And
now that's the hyperbole.
Yeah,
that you're talking
that's
about
the thing.
The,
you know, the minute you talk about hyperbole, though, you're beginning to qualify the notion of this as ethical model. It seems to me, you know, you're beginning to say Jesus really is calling to perfection, but there's also a certain shock element. There's a certain hyperbole is to overemphasize something. So you're beginning to say there seems to be something a little bit going on here, a little bit different going on than simply laying out a strict rule ethic or normative ethic for how to decide. And I'm okay with that, but it's just, I think we should know that that's what's going on.
You know, as we talk, I give a little rest to, because I think what we're trying to do is always interpret, and I do it all the time too, interpret it individualistically, whereas I think it helps me somehow to take this seriously, to say this is the call of the community, for the community, with whom I am bound. And in a sense, I am not able to love my enemies, but some of my sisters and brothers in the community are. And in a sense, I don't know whether this is in Matthew, I think it is presuppositionally, they do it for me because we do it together. And that's the next section we want to get into, where my friend Jim Bailey talks about sort of some individualistic pitfalls.
I think what we're reading about the rich young ruler, in a sense, this afternoon, where the disciples question this as the young man goes away disheartened because of the requirements of the kingdom. And then that qualification comes, with God nothing is impossible, which would seem to point to that second understanding, that the understanding of this as such a requirement for perfection that it pushes us to a gracious God, makes us aware.
But notice where it pushed the rich young, or the rich young man, where did it push him? Out.
Okay.
Not to a gracious God, but out.
Except that I can, you know, as I close my eyes to that rich young ruler, I see a perfectionist coming to Jesus. You know, he's just totally restless with himself, okay? And I hear Jesus say, okay, so let's play your game. You know, if you're going to play your game, the only way you're really going to get into the kingdom is, you know, turn your back on everything and then come follow me. And that really blows the guy, the young man away.
He walks out.
Huh?
He walks away.
Well, yeah, he's a perfectionist who cannot live up to his own perfectionism.
Do you agree with that? Is that the... I don't know. You were talking this afternoon about movements that demand great things of its, or make great demands on its followers, is somehow involving people with this kind of passion that we were talking about, the way groups that don't make these demands, you make a bland demand, you get a bland member. You make a passionate demand, you get a passionate member. And that's kind of what you were saying, wasn't it?
There's a sense where we can water down through our interpretation the radical nature of the call to a point where we, or the community, can fulfill it. And it seems like that's not an honest interpretation of what's going on in the Sermon on the Mount. I mean, it is a radical call. It is not something the community can fulfill.
Well, in both in terms of where we're going to get at the end, with Matthew 25, 31 to 46, and the way how we got started tonight with the meditation in Vespers, what is the shape of the call to perfection?
There is something to me that seems we're missing, and that is that we sat in the presence of the reality of the radicalness of the relationship in a devotional that makes it very clear, I think, as we sat there, this is a righteousness higher than the righteousness of the world. And it's a righteousness, as we said, a relationship which Jesus says is a higher righteousness.
But my question, and I want to press it a little bit, is what is the shape of obedience to this higher righteousness? What is its form? Is there in the devotion tonight? What is it? One small step in the right direction. I think that is, in a sense, the key. One small step in the right direction. The thing that makes it blessed is that we are moving toward, oriented toward, have our face firmly set toward the blessed vision. I'm stealing a little bit from the end now. The blessed vision. And it is not that we immediately, overwhelmingly, with a great single act, achieve that obedience or that perfection or that vision, but that we take the necessary next step and next step and next step. That's what I think is involved in this. Yes, sir.
I was going to say, too, it's also, you were talking about before, it was a livable, is it manageable? It's more livable and manageable for me if this radical call towards right living, if we remember that part of that is radical forgiveness, that part of that righteous way is radical forgiveness, and then that gets us out of the perfectionism trap and exclusionary trap that we're afraid is drawing us into.
Well, let's just...
But that's a given. That's a given of the relationship. And do you have to say it every time for it in order to, you know? I mean, did Jesus have to say every time that he was going to teach us something? Well, first of all, you got to remember, I forgive you because you're sinners. I mean, the danger that I see is that we really don't want to take the radicalness of this because of our Lutheran hang-up of works righteousness. And do not really want to say that in the relationship, God makes a difference in our lives.
And does God make enough of a difference in our life so that we in our common life will be a contrast community, a community whose words and actions will say, no, picking up the devotion tonight, no, 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 to what we all in this room know are the false gods and false values of our society. And I'm saying, do your people in your parish and do my friends and students and I myself at my Christian Community Wartburg Seminary, do we feel we are blessed and energized because we are taking this stance and being part of God's mission to make things right? That's my question.
I'm a little concerned with the notion of contrast.
Okay, tell us why.
I'm a confessionalist. It tends to say this is where I'm at and you may be somewhere else and that's where you are. This is where I have to be and this is why I have to be here. And I wouldn't focus on being different.
You wouldn't focus on being different, but...
I'd be focused on being faithful.
But if you are faithful, then you will be different.
You'll be different. But it's a way of looking at it, I think, that doesn't even try to discover the contrast. It tries to discover the meaning of faithfulness.
But once you have looked at the meaning of faithfulness, it seems to me that the reality then of the Sermon on the Mount is saying, if you have discovered faithfulness, you are going to experience persecution. And the question we're asking is that both that discovery and of faithfulness of what God wants for the right relationship of our situation, using your topic tonight, for the righting of our relationship to nature, is our discovery of that itself a joy and a blessing, a joy and a blessing that can be molded with the suffering it will cause and the confusion it will cause, and still come out joy and blessing? Isn't that the question we're asking? And I guess my hidden answer is yes. We're going to have to go to the end now. I want us to try reading this next section, 6:1-18, because it's still discussing the notion of righteousness. Will somebody read it? We're still loading up the question, is all this, the Sermon on the Mount, something that we can take seriously? Who's reading? Who's reading?
Beware of practicing your piety before men in order to be seen by them, for then you will have no reward from your Father who is in heaven.
How does that square with let your light show shine before all? That's a very interesting thing. We'll have to look at that. Okay, go ahead.
Thus, when you give alms, sound no trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be praised by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward. But when you give alms, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your alms may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. And when you pray, you must not be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and at the street corners, that they may be seen by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward. But when you pray, go into your room and shut the door, and pray to your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you. And in praying, do not heap up empty phrases as the Gentiles do, for they think they will be heard for their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him. Pray then like this: Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. What does this do to the new translation? Mm-hmm. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For if you forgive men their trespasses, your heavenly Father also will forgive you. But if you do not forgive men their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses. And when you fast, do not look dismal like the hypocrites, for they disfigure their faces that their fasting may be seen by men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward. But when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face, that your fasting may not be seen by men, but your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you.
Okay, now to summarize some of the things that my friend Jim said about that, he looked at this whole section as being a critique by Matthew of individualistic distortion of piety, which eclipses the community's mission. Let me just read this paragraph. It subverts a community's real mission of serving the world into an internal preoccupation with individuals who are wanting to feel good about themselves. That's a theme that runs through it. In fact, such distortion of piety introduces competition and comparison into community life and destroys relationships and directions for the mission by the total community. And then he goes on to say, in this situation, the Lord's Prayer is introduced as a corrective. It stands here at the center of the entire Sermon on the Mount as a corrective to any distortion of righteousness, dikaiosune, into self-aggrandizement. If it turns in on itself individualistically, it is a distortion of God's righteousness. God's righteousness exists for the world, for the community, and for the world through the community. This model prayer refocuses the community's attention from individualistic piety to the paramount issues regarding the holiness of God's name and the manifestations of God's gracious activity and will in human affairs. It redirects attention to the essentials for life and community, that is, daily bread, forgiveness, and deliverance from the test and temptation that the world places upon you. Just as praying for the enemies exists alongside doing good towards them, so here the model prayer, in that it becomes a model for all our praying, is not intended as an alternative to the community's doing of righteousness, dikaiosune. Rather, prayer refocuses and empowers the faith action of the community. In this prayer, there is a deep binding of the surprising graciousness of God and the community's action. The Lord's Prayer reveals that the will of God is not that of a demanding tyrant, but a loving parent. And the will of God brings health and homeless not only to the contrast community, but also through it to the larger world. Now we've looked at it, stumbled through it, read through it, thought through it, and we're left with our question, is this far above the Christian communities we know, or is it a serious call, challenge to a new life? Well, let me quote from a friend and mentor, also a Lutheran struggling with our ethos, Joe Sittler. Joe had some very interesting things to say and struggled with the meaning of the Sermon on the Mount. And I looked for a marvelous quotation I once used in an article I wrote from him, and I can't find the wording, but I know the substance of it. He would said, only the undiluted total vision of the Sermon on the Mount will have the drawing power to bring individuals and the community toward the blessed vision. And he would say that the Lutheran thing, you know, that it's the, it crushes us because it's impossible, and so therefore we throw ourselves on the mercy of God, stops us before we even take the first step in the game. He said it must be taken seriously as the vision which will draw us toward it. That's one thing. Then I want to say one other thing, and then we may have a little time to discuss, and then we're through. It seems to me that if you look at Matthew in terms of Matthew's redaction, and the mountain peaks of Matthew's shaping of the territory, which is his story of Jesus, you cannot even begin to think about the seriousness of the Sermon on the Mount unless you think about the text designated for Christ the King Sunday, the last Sunday of the year, and you'll preach on it this year. Matthew 25, 31 to 46. And even if we run over time, I want us to take time to read that and say a couple things about it. Whose turn is it to read? The text for Christ the King Sunday. Who's got it? Matthew 25, 31 to 46. It's very familiar, but I want us to hear the words ringing in our ears again, okay?
When the Son of Man comes in his glory.
When the human being with capital H and capital B, if you use Machen's rewriting, okay?
And all the angels with him. Then he will sit on his glorious throne. Before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate them one from another, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep at his right hand, but the goats at the left. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, Come, O blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous...
Okay, stop. Now, how many... You had several lists of things that can be done. I was counting. I think this was 7 steps, wasn't it? 7 things that could be done. Not a single one of these activities is impossible for any of us. Not a single one. But every single one moves in the direction of the great vision, doesn't it? Every single one moves in the direction of God's vision for the world, for the community, human community, for the community of nature, put together in the Sermon on the Mount. Go ahead.
Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed thee, or thirsty and give thee drink? And when did we see thee a stranger and welcome thee, or naked and clothe thee? And when did we see thee sick or in prison and visit thee? And the king will answer them, Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these my brethren, you did it to me.
Okay, you did it to me. Who's the me there? The human being. The new humanity. The new humanity, and we're going to do that when we work on the resurrection texts, who comes, who does not experience in Matthew's gospel, an ascension to get him off stage so that the Spirit can come and do the work. Who in Matthew's gospel says what? Lo, I am with you always to the close of the age. And the mode of his being with them always to the close of the age is to be in the hungry one, the imprisoned one, the 7. And that's exactly what we heard in the devotion tonight. Where do you find God? In the broken situation of the world. This isn't new, but this is what Matthew is saying, and saying it powerfully. Keep reading.
Then he will say to those at his left hand, Depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit me. Then they will also...
That was either 6 or 7 if you count 6. Sick and in prison is 2, it's 7 if you count. Go ahead.
Then they will also answer, Lord, when did we see thee hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not minister to thee? Then he will answer them, Truly I say to you, as you did it not to one of the least of these, you did it not to me. And they will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life.
Okay, now, the other thing was that this picks up another motif in our meditation tonight, judgment. It's there to the very end. Matthew says it makes a difference. And it is so serious that Matthew puts down this tough, tough judgment text. Now, we're at the end. It seems to me that I want at least to struggle with the answer that, correctly understood, this Sermon on the Mount can be a serious call to any Christian congregation, which, taking the call seriously, will become, a little modification here as we go along, the contrast community that my friend Jim Bailey is talking about. It is not a call to religious heroics, but it is a call to the next manageable step, which nevertheless moves not individuals, I would say, but individuals in community toward the fulfilling of that vision. Now, does that make sense? Does that make sense? Or do you disagree?
I disagree.
Okay. Why do you disagree?
Well, I don't think it has to be an or. I guess I've been thrown off by your question.
Okay.
You ask, is it, to press us, or is it to give us the next manageable step? I don't see any reason it has to be either or. I would agree that it shows us a vision of the kingdom that we should be following, but it's not a particularly comfortable or comforting reading to me as I sit there and read it and look at my own life or my own community or my own tradition. I think we see the judgment on ourselves when we read that, and it's like this passage about the goats and the sheep. That's not a comforting vision for me. It reinforces our need of a gracious God. So both ends.
Isn't it comforting to you that you're still in the church and that your people are still there and still coming, drawn by this vision? Isn't that a kind of comfort? Isn't that a kind of blessedness? I was saying to some people this afternoon, it is not for me at all self-evident that people will even come to church on a Sunday morning.
But I guess the thing that I would say, probably without thinking, is they're not coming because of this vision. They're coming because they're called by Christ. If they're coming because of this vision, it becomes a sort of a gnosis, in community of those who know what they want, what the right way is. They're coming because of this personal relationship with God, and then once they're in the community, they learn the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew makes it very clear when he has in chapter 4 the disciples call, and then in chapter 5 starts the Sermon on the Mount.
How long have your people been there in your congregation? How many times have they heard the Sermon on the Mount preached?
Oh, I don't know. Most of my congregation is not ethnic Lutherans, so I don't know.
Well, are they generic Christians?
Some of them. Other traditions, some of them. They've heard it many times, I'm sure.
It seems to me this whole vision begins in chapter 4, 4:23. Jesus coming, preaching the gospel, the good news of the kingdom, not preaching a whole new set of laws and rules and regulations.
But if the kingdom is not laws but a vision.
Yes, the vision is good news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's not a whole set of new regulations Jesus lays down. It's a vision.
But a vision that sometimes looks like a new set of rules. At least to some people.
Yeah, but then it's no longer good news. The moment we take the gospel and just make another law out of it, another set of rules out of it, then it's no longer good news.
Well, to make it laws and say that there's some concreteness to it.
Well, it's a vision.
Yeah, well.
How it can be.
Well, one of the things we discussed this afternoon said, if you bring your gift to the altar. And remember that your brother or sister has something against you. Drop it. Stop the organist. Go out and be reconciled to your brother or sister. Now, is that a law? Or is that an invitation, an admonition to a new quality of human relationship?
See, I think there's a qualitative difference in what happens when Jesus comes along. I don't see him raising the laws to a new and higher and more difficult plane. I see him going back to the covenant that God asked people to be in from the beginning, and we pick it up this Sunday again in Deuteronomy, in the reading from Deuteronomy, where you know, God says to obey God by loving the Lord first by loving the Lord. I mean, and I think what Jesus does is bring the fact that the whole point of all the law is relationship. Relationship with God, relationship with other, and that's what God called us to. Those are the two great commandments, to love God and neighbor as ourselves, and I think also to love the earth, take care of that, you know, the whole earth that's been given to us to take care of. And I think that's the essence of what's in here, in the Sermon on the Mount, and what we're called to do differently is to do it out of a different spirit. And I think that's what makes it possible rather than impossible.
In terms of the good news, just building on what you're saying, we've got to quit. Is it good news for us or for any of your people for whom you preach that Jesus has promised to be with us always? Is that good news?
Sometimes yes and sometimes no.
Hmm?
Sometimes yes and sometimes no.
I think that's good news.
It's disturbing.
Yeah,
I think that's good news. And is it another dimension of that good news that Jesus is with us many ways, but also in the hungry, the naked, the imprisoned, the sick? Is that good news? And if it is good news, the good news of Emmanuel, and that is the mode of God or the human being, capital H, capital B, being with us, that is a kind of joy and blessedness, isn't it? Or haven't we been talking about it right or preaching about it right? Why don't we stop with that question? We can come back at it tomorrow.
Okay, isn't the blessing just being in the struggle? You know, being in the vision. I mean, we're never...
Bringing in the struggle with him and the community.
Exactly.
That's
it. Yeah.
And I'm asking myself, Kristen, do our people feel that is blessedness and joy?
Only when they're in it together.
Only when they're in it together.
Well, there's also pain in that struggle, and I think a lot of my people experience a lot of the pain of being in that struggle.
We have also take joy in the pain. Do they find a joy with it?
Well, we have a fish operation, which is an ecumenical ministry. That's housed in our church facilities. There are 4,000 to 6,000 people that go through there every month. 4,000 to 6,000. Imagine just it's just to find it, food and clothing. That's all we can possibly manage. Mm-hmm. You know? But there's not a day that goes by, you know, that you have to deal with the demanding. Or with those who will just outright abuse you because you won't do their other things for them, mm-hmm. that they demand being done. And boy, they can lay guilt trips on you, mm-hmm. like you can't believe, you know. that too is a part of the pain of being in the struggle, having to deal with that, I think. And you know, I don't want to try to make my congregation look more heroic than any other congregation. I mean, all of you have your own stories to be able to share. But my people experience, you know, real tiredness.
Are they consciously aware that they are a contrast community or a community that's different from the world, and they want the world to see their differentness?
I think they take a great sense of pride in the fact that we're doing it, that we're, you know, we're doing it.
Well, I think, I applaud that. I think that's what it's all about. I think that we've been promised that kind of a reward when we look for faithfulness and find ourselves against the stream. I think there is a reward there, particularly if we do it together. I think that's right. There's a kind of not worldly joy that we dare to call blessedness in that.
Another part of the pain, however, is the recognition, you know, we're just band-aiding. I mean, what we are doing isn't getting to the root causes of, you know, that bring those people to the door in the first place.
But don't the band-aiders learn by that experience some of the things that have to be done the next step? Now, we have people like that in our congregation in Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Denver, where the House of Studies was near. And the congregation members that worked with the food kitchens and worked with the giving out the clothing, they were the ones that got radicalized. And some of them, not all of them, some of them didn't have any more energy, were older, but some of them had taken the next step to get involved in homeless advocacy and so forth. And I have the feeling, you know, what stopped the Vietnam War? Remember? Two men in a typewriter looking for a candidate. And who was it, do you remember who turned them down before Eugene McCarthy came along? I mean, you start somewhere. And that's what you mean by waiting for, you're hopeful. The next step comes somehow, and we get guided by the next step.
That same criticism is made of Mother Teresa and her work, that all she's doing is, you know, I mean, she's literally doing that. I mean, and saying that, you know, the reason we take care of these people is because we see Jesus in every one of them, and that's what we do. When people say, well, she's just, you know, just some relief, she's not doing anything to change the structures that create this, you know, injustice. And yet, she can have immediate access to any world leader at the drop of a phone call to make something happen. And people come there from all over the world. Political leaders want a day to just work with her. And, you know, I think that we can't underestimate the power of, you know, of that small band-aid that you do. But it is done in community. And I don't know how you could... I feel the conviction more when I think about it individually than when I try to hear that kind of corporately. Because I know I can't do all of it.
But isn't it true to our experience that if you're trying to make a difference in the world and say some of the no's that he was talking about tonight, you simply can't do it alone. Mm-hmm. And you are thrown into necessary networking. When I'm home in Dubuque before she got to be 91 years old, I used to ask Louise Halliburton, my Quaker friend, how I should write to to my congresspeople about anything that had to do with the arms race, because she kept up on it. Sister Dorothy Marie Hennessy has a married old brother in Nicaragua. She is my mind that tells me what I should think about that. And we all have this network of people that inform us and guide us as we try to say our no or move the next step. And I ask myself, and this is a very difficult question, why is it that so much of my network that extends my mind and extends my action and we work together, why is it outside my congregation? Mm-hmm. That's a very serious question for me, because the people in our congregation are good people. Haven't we found a way or a structure to join them together with other groups to be this total Christian contrast or new community? See, I would have stopped earlier, but I don't have any water. Well, it's an interesting question. The role of the sermon on
A few of us have to preach on Sunday.
What are you going to say?
Go to Holden.